Welcome to the concurrent session on the sustainability of the life insurance industry, and I guess by the size of the audience, it looks like it's a topic that's going to continue on beyond the last 12 or 18 months, where it's certainly garnered a lot of attention. In terms of the format, this is going to be a panel session, so the idea here is to try and make it as interactive as possible. So we're going to have 5 to 10 minutes introductory comments from each of the speakers and then go into a Q&A style environment. So don't be shy. Feel free to make your way to the microphones and throw some questions up. We'll have some anyway, just as you guys get warmed up. I think in terms of the panel today, we're fortunate enough to have a group of people that are eminently qualified to talk about this topic. We have Mark Stewart, CEO of RGA, and Pereira, CFO of Cominsure, and Darren Wickham from Tau, previous Actuary of the Year. So, look, without further ado, I'll hand it over to the guys and we'll have some initial comments on their views around the life insurance industry and take it from there.
Okay, thanks, Wade. And look, I might just start by talking about the group market and then come back to individual after. It's fair to say the group business is where the bigger headlines and losses were in 2013. In our portfolio at RGA, we had started to see group disability claims start trending up actually as far back as probably late 2010. And since then, the trends have sustained and if anything, probably gotten worse. And this really followed a period of very competitive market conditions where we saw terms relaxed and a lot of growth for the industry as well. And this was particularly the case for industry funds. So these richer benefits and looser terms coincided with some other things that were happening sort of more broadly, which was the increase in the lawyer activity, and also a sort of a step change increase in the awareness that members have about their life insurance through their superannuation funds. And so when you start putting all of these things together, you get what we've had, which is the very dramatic increase in claims levels over the last 2 or 3 years. And one aspect that particularly exacerbates the problem for us here is that in Australia, we don't have a time limit for claim submission. So when we talk about this dramatic increase in claims levels, we're not talking about increasing claims for the last 1, 2 or 3 underwriting years. We're talking about an increase in claims that goes right back 10 or more underwriting years. So what we've really done over the last probably 12, 18, 24 months is rewritten the financial history of our business. And we've done that with the benefit of hindsight, far away from the actual event periods. And that's a big problem. It's very hard to manage a business with those dynamics. I think one way, when we look at how do we get to where we got, there's a lot of tactical reasons that I've just touched on. But I think it's also probably fair to say that in the past, the risk exposures of the products probably haven't really been understood, priced for or monitored correctly. I think as an industry, we've relied extensively on the ability to reprice in the future, on the presumption that if we get it wrong, we'll just reprice and fix it. But that doesn't work very well when it takes you many years to work out that you got it wrong. If it takes you 5 or more years to work out you got it wrong, having the ability to reprice after 3 years isn't very valuable at all. And I think the other thing in group is we've relied extensively on the very large data volumes that typically come in for an industry fund. Large data looks like it's really credible, but what we've found, as I mentioned earlier, is that that's moved with the benefit of hindsight, and having large data volumes has probably given us the wrong signal rather than maybe requiring us to dig deeper than we might have otherwise have done. So where are we now? Well, I guess in terms of our in-force contracts, there's not a lot we can do. The one thing I think that we can look at is claims management. And we've been looking at this pretty closely at RGA. We had our big reserve strengthening in the middle of last year, and we got our share of headlines that I'm sure you've all heard about. And I guess we're seeing that there's a good opportunity to ask ourselves the question, are we paying claims in line with the policy terms and conditions, or are we paying additional claims over and above that? And we're seeing opportunities to improve the claims outcomes, still paying the claims that are valid under the policy as well, though. But going forward, obviously there's the big price increases now, 80 to 100% is typical. That can continue, but I think we've really got a burning platform for change now, and we really should try and use it. if the only thing that happens now is price increases, I think it'll only be a matter of time before the industry's back in a room like this talking about the issues again. It might be different people, though. Probably won't be me. So what sort of changes should we be looking about? Well, firstly, I think we've got to look carefully at the benefit terms and conditions. And none of this is rocket science. In some ways, it's unwinding the changes that have occurred over the last 5 years. But really, when you stand back and look at TPD, we've gone a long way from what the original intent of the policy is. In fact, we've gone a long way probably from what the man on the street thinks that they're actually buying insurance cover for. And similarly, when you look at eligibility, we're giving cover to people who are already disabled. Now, if you ask anyone, pretty much in any other industry, would you give insurance to, cover to someone who's already eligible to claim? They'd say that's madness. But that's what we're doing. So there's some things we need to look closely at. And when I describe these things, we're not talking about, in my mind, peripheral things on the fringe of the product. We're talking about some of the core things that have been in the product for a while. So we need to look at some of the fundamental changes. But why should we do it? Well, we need to get more stability into this industry, I think. I mean, for insurance, it's sold through superannuation. Insurance is almost a it is a secondary sale. This isn't the primary purpose of why these people have these products at all. And also, I think we need to think about the fairness of the pricing and the product structures between current and future members, and not just think about fairness in the terms of who's getting paid claims. I mean, ultimately, if you think about TPD, the incidence rates are still only one or two per mil. So there's 998 or so members who are paying for that one or two who are getting all the benefits. And that needs to be weighed up better than what it has been in the past. So turning to individual business, and I think the situation is different, in fact, probably quite a bit different. I'm not even sure there's a strong consensus as to what the issues are. Some people like to talk about claims issues, some lapses. Some people talk about, some breakdowns in operational practices across the industry. And then, of course, Advisor REM gets talked about a lot. So there's not even, I think, a clear consensus as to what the issues are, or maybe another way of saying it is there's lots of ways of describing the same issues, and that makes it quite complicated. Our view at RJ is that the lapse and claims issues are real and are affecting, a good portion of the industry, if not the majority. One of the underlying causes is the fact that our annual step premium product structure just means that we're putting the rates up on our policyholders every year. So a typical policyholder gets faced with, let's say, a 10 to 15% increase in their premiums every year. That far outstrips the rate of growth of their income. It far outstrips the rate of growth of their other costs of living. It probably far outstrips their perceived value from the insurance. Now, from an actuarial point of view, you could argue why it doesn't. But they don't think about it that way. They think about it, I've still got 200,000 or 500,000, whatever the amount is of cover, and yet my price has just gone up 15%. So this has got it's an affordability issue, and we've baked it into the structure of our products. And what happens then is, well, the affordability issue is leading to higher lapses. And that's what's coming through. And in fact, the lapses are probably most extreme for the people getting close to retirement ages, because they're more attuned to their financial needs, they have less need for insurance. And yet, as you've seen in the press recently, these are the exact people who are actually coming through in claims for the one who hang around. So I'm not sure the product structure is really getting at the heart of what's in the best interests of the customers throughout their life cycle. Another thing about the affordability is it leads to higher lapses, which we also think leads to higher claims. If you think about who lapses, what's the healthy people? It has to be skewed towards the healthy people. Financial planners tell people who are unhealthy not to lapse. They'd be derelict in their duty if they didn't. So we've got this thing called anti-selective lapses, and it's not something that's talked about a lot here in Australia, but it's something that it's studied and analysed and talked about extensively in other markets. And ironically, in these markets, they've got a lot lower lapses than we have. Their lapse rates are probably around half, yet they're already more attuned to it. So I think we're a little bit behind where some of the more sophisticated markets are in terms of understanding how our lapse and claims experience are interrelated and how they might unfold going forward. Another cause on the individual market, I think, is generous underwriting practices. So our medical testing limits here in Australia have changed a lot, certainly since the early 2000s, and in fact they're now the highest in the world by some margin. So a 40-year-old male can get $2.5 million of cover with no required medical testing at all. That's a very large amount of cover, and so a lot of reliance on what's a pretty simple medical application questionnaire. You don't have to be an actuary to know that if you do less underwriting, you're going to get more claims. But the other thing to remember is that the less underwriting you do, the lot easier it is for policyholders to move from one company to another. So you can create the situation where lapses become easier as well. So again, this is where, in our minds, you get these lapse and claims issues that are related. And as I said, for group business, I think there's a fair question to ask ourselves is, did we really understand the risk exposures and did we really price and monitor them correctly? And I think that's a sobering news or sobering question for us as actuaries, because that's probably been our job. And it's probably been us who we need to look for, to see who probably didn't sort of alert the industry to the things that were happening at the time, but also needs to be us who's going to lead the industry through into the solutions. So what are some of the solutions for individual business? Well, there's already a lot of focus on improving client engagement and retention, and that seems to be generally going pretty well. But I think there's a limit as to how much that can really benefit us, because we've still got this sort of structural affordability problem embedded in our products. So I guess to wrap up, we're still seeing a lot of opportunity for some true innovation here. True innovation by really exploring alternative premium structures. Real product differentiation. A lot of the products have tended to harmonise towards each other. And the other thing is that given the IFA channel, economics are becoming increasingly challenging, looking at new forms and channels for distribution. And they seem to be things that people are working on now. Other markets have had these issues before. The individual issues are by no means new or unique, and they've all solved them. The biggest problem or the biggest barrier we have is the first mover disadvantage that I think is generally discussed and pretty well known. And if we find some way around that, I think we're in for some pretty exciting times. And with that, I'll hand over to Ian.
Thanks, Mark. I'll try and add some different thoughts to what you said, though I don't disagree with anything, really. So I was asked, well, has the life insurance industry got some sustainability issues? Well, I guess at the grand scheme, I think no. Customers want or need our products. What we do as an industry in terms of protecting Australians is very important. And all the significant insurers and reinsurers participating in the Australian market are part of the large diversified groups whose overall financial viability hasn't been significantly damaged by the recent issues in the Australian life insurance industry. However, there are clearly some pretty unsustainable practices in some areas. And the two various obvious issues that Mark identified are industry fund profitability and retail advice. For the industry fund segment, yes, the industry's been absolutely hammered by these long-duration TPD claims, particularly through lawyer involvement. But I feel the concentration of bargaining power with the large industry funds, the number of industry participants and the role of reinsurers combined with the winner's curse meant this was always going to end in tears. Whilst price is the main driver for who wins a scheme, I think it's always going to be difficult to make I guess what we consider a sustainable margin. I guess one challenge that I guess we face is it possible for one or two players to get a significant expense advantage through scale or a claims management advantage through technology or maybe other methods so they can actually get a significant enough pricing advantage to overcome the negative effects of the winner's curse? I'm not convinced, I guess, at the moment, and without being able to have a competitive differentiation, I guess, greater than that winner's curse threat, I think is a problem. And a further issue is how low a profit margin should you rationally accept if the alternative is losing a major scheme and hence dealing with a significant expense viability issue? I guess if you're a particular insurance company, that the answer might be, yes, I'll take quite a low margin. But clearly that's not conducive to overall industry profits. I think the level of repricing we've seen and the strong stance we're seeing from reinsurers in the group market should see a return to some reasonable profits in the short term. But the market structure issues that I've referred to, I think, do make this market a little difficult over the longer term. In the retail advice segment, I think there are also some long-term sustainability issues. The issue of high upfront commissions is commonly discussed. Typically, the amounts are over 100%. But I guess having spent 20 years in the New Zealand market where commission rates are now over 200%, my thoughts when I came here was, well, Australia, you need to toughen up. And in spite of the incentives to churn in New Zealand, the lapse rates are typically lower than in Australia, around 12%. I think the latest industry stats I saw for retail in Australia was 16%. Now, there'll be product and regulatory factors in play, but I think another issue is that in Australia, there are some widely available closed substitutes to getting advice from a financial planner. Direct products and also cover from your super provider. Now, in pure benefit terms, the retail advice products, I guess, tend to be better. They certainly have more bells and whistles. But the cost of these benefits and the cost of distributing these benefits means that consumers might start questioning the benefits of retaining an advice product. For example, is the pricing benefit of being part of an underwritten pool worth the extra distribution and administration costs that a consumer has to pay? Now, given recent upheavals in the group market and the changes in pricing in the group market, the balance may be moving, but I do think that's an issue for the retail segment. And I guess our industry cost structure is based on retail being a product provided to a reasonable proportion of our customers. If more and more start transferring their cover to industry, then it does question some of the viability of some of the retail distribution methods. I guess regardless of the threat of substitutes, retail advice is a hard business to get out of, even if you don't like the economics. And as Mark mentioned, the first mover disadvantage is particularly painful. And in some respects, I think the 3-year guarantee that we, I guess, used to offer in the group space is more attractive than the freedom to reprice on a yearly basis in yearly renewable. At least in the group space, you knew that if you didn't reprice at the 3-year mark, you'd be stuck with the rate for 3 years. In retail, we seem to be able to postpone indefinitely in the hope that a competitor will move first, and I guess we're in a position where no one's willing to move. I guess the industry sustainability issue that maybe worries me more than even those two issues is there something that we've missed? Is there some biotechnology or data advantage that the new entrant or an alternative product can come in with, which makes, I guess, the issues that we're dealing with today redundant? I guess we've seen a number of industries where technology change has had a dramatic impact. But I guess I still come back to my initial thoughts that, yes, overall the industry is sustainable, but I'm be really keen to hear audience thoughts on that. Thank you.
Thanks, Ian. I'd just like to clear something up. I'm not Brett Clark. Apologies for those people that came for Brett Clark. As a result, I have to confess I'm not able to speak as authoritatively on some issues as you might otherwise expect. So any subsequent discussion about AFL, please, I'll leave to my colleagues here. Especially anything to do with James Heard, the Premiership, or Hawthorne. So I'll just get that out of the way. You'll be met with a dignified but dumbfounded silence. For me, there's two crises in the industry, and they're blowing up at the same time. And I very determinedly use the word crisis because they're generating significant losses, and in the super space, they're leading to price increases, which I think is beginning to seriously erode members' retirement savings. So I've used the word crisis, but I think when I reflect on this, I reflect on my childhood actually. And when I was a kid, I loved playing board games. I really loved playing board games, and like most actuaries, I do confess I like Dungeons and Dragons. And I can see a few of you out there that have rolled the 12-sided dice before to see if your magic wand was strong enough to kill a dragon. But the board game that I really loved the best was Cluedo. So I don't know if you remember Cluedo. Cluedo was the, the murder mystery game. You went around the board searching for clues, and at the end you triumphantly declare it was Mrs. Peacock in the library with the candlestick, or Professor Plum in the billiard room with the rope. And I think these crises are a little bit like Cluedo, and there's many suspects and there's many potential ways of looking at it. So in retail, coming back to my Cluedo analogy, the main crisis is, we've talked about, Ian and Mark have talked about, high lapse rates. So what was the venue for the murder in this case? Was it financial advisors with their high commissions in their office? Or is it consumers at home doing the research on their computers? Was the weapon, are we talking about churning, twisting the business to other places? Or is it the ageing population just leading to higher premiums and people realising that cover can be expensive at higher ages? Or was the murderer the policyholder themselves that are empowered by all of this information now that's online, the ability to do research and realise they can get a better deal elsewhere? So that consumer activism, I think, has been quite important. And in group life, there's a whole other range of suspects, and there's more complex, and I think there's actually four sessions at the FSF today talking about different ones, different causes. But in group life, the murder could be in income protection. We've seen some funds go up significantly. The venue for the murder could have been TPD. TPD has been a problem. Sorry, I'm losing my microphone here. Can you hear me still? Yep. Was saying before, we feel like Justin Bieber with these things on. So, was it in industry funds or corporates? And industry funds seem to have had worse experience than corporate funds. Or was the venue the Gold Coast? And I say that advisedly because it seems that Southeast Queensland has particularly high rates of TPD claims. Maybe that's because it coincides with the home of Shine Lawyers. I don't know. But there are arguments for and against where the murder took place. But who was the murderer? Was it plaintiff lawyers? Was it those anti-selecting members? Was it trustees and tender managers that encouraged looser terms and conditions? Was it insurers and reinsurers that mispriced? Was it the courts who have reinterpreted TPD so that unlikely to ever work again now means a 49% chance instead of a 5% chance? Was it APRA or the government? And in terms of a weapon, was it apathy? Was it people just not being aware that they had cover? Was it anti-selection? Was it unemployment? Australia has pretty good unemployment, but regionally it's a bit patchy. Was it loose TPD definitions, easy eligibility or increased benefits? Or possibly a rise in mental illness? So if I boil it all down, was it the financial advisor in the office doing the twist? Or was it Maurice Blackburn in the courtroom with the apathy? And I think the answer is it's probably a combination of all of these things. And for retail, if I had to put my money on one thing, I think the ageing population is a big factor, not just the twisting. And in group, my personal view is apathy is a key thing. And what I mean by that is we've given default cover to people that never realised they actually had the cover. So for years we've actually made profits out on the back of members that never realised they had cover. Those profits are now being reversed and revised into losses, and people are becoming more and more aware, and the plaintiff lawyers are actually doing a reasonable job in assisting these people being aware that they had cover. Anyway, that's all I had to say. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, guys. So we'll kick off with some questions, but you know, as I said at the outset, the idea is to be as interactive as possible, so feel free to make your way to the microphone. Contrary to Darren's comments, there are no plans at the moment to create an actuarial boy band from the members on the stage. We'll try and stick to the script. And I think, you know, for mine, the real interesting sort of stuff that comes out of a lot of what you've all said, and maybe it's timing, maybe it's a bit of a coincidence that a lot of this seemed to sort of come about post-financial crisis. So a lot of the discussion really is focusing around, you know, whether we're experiencing now in the life insurance industry a natural part of a cycle, although maybe more severe than past cycles, or whether these sorts of changes are being brought on by broader structural dynamics. So interested in your take on those issues, and I guess particularly, you know, if there's an element of both, then which ones do you think are going to really dominate sort of the themes that we see going forward? So Mark, maybe starting with you might be...
I think you'd have to say it is both. I think it'd be naive to say there's no cyclical elements at all. I mean, we haven't had the GFC really in Australia, but in some pockets, as Darren mentioned, there's been some downturn. But certainly I can assure you, if you try and explain to overseas stakeholders that unemployment's a driver of our results, they find that very hard to believe, given to what's happened, when you compare it to what's happened in the US or Europe or so on. So I think there's a cyclical element, but I think that there is some structural things, as I mentioned, that we should be focusing on. And even if it is a cycle, I think we need to ask ourselves the question, is that okay? Because I think that the answer when you're thinking about insurance through group superannuation is, I'm not sure that is okay. It's people's retirement savings that we're playing with and impacting here. And I think we should be trying to take action to minimise the cycle.
I guess I think there's some cycle aspects to it, but I think it's more an underwriting type cycle than a pure financial cycle. I think we saw, 5 to 10 years ago, we were thinking we were making healthy profits on this segment of business, the industry fund segment, and premium rates came down. The market then got bigger and bigger, I guess. So certainly everyone was keen to participate in the growth of the market, and it made, if you thought you had your pricing right, it made rational sense to go and compete strongly in that market, and that has, I think, contributed heavily to the losses, as well as to the, you know, what I think of maybe slightly one-off issues around the long-tail TPD claims being something that we really hadn't thought about maybe 4 or 5 years ago, or even 2 or 3 years ago.
Darren, you mentioned some of the demographic themes in your sort of opening remarks. You've got a particular view.
Yeah, so on the retail side, if it is indeed demographic based, then I think, well, that's clearly a long-term structural issue. The population's getting older. We're going to see more of that. Consumer activism. I mean, there has been a revolution in consumer behaviour. People check research websites. I can't see that part going away. You know, maybe over time we'll see changes in commission structures that'll flow through. On the group side, there are definite issues with product terms and conditions, and until those are addressed, I think we will continue to see increasing prices. The lawyer impact, is this a once-off, or is it going to be there forever? Are claims delays going to be long forever? My personal view is that eventually the claims delays will come back, but I don't think any insurer is out there willing to bet their balance sheet at this point on that that phenomenon. But interestingly, there's a bit of a play over between group and retail on individual termination rates on income protection policies. And I think there's a phenomenon that there's lots of claims. There's lots of group claims. We're doubling premiums, but there's not double the number of claims managers in the group space. So there's a big call on group resources, and I think that has a flow-on effect with retail because claims teams all over the place are stressed. So.
And just sort of picking up on that theme there, we were talking about if it is a structural, you know, shift that we're seeing, and you know, it's impacting throughout the entire value chain, whether it's the ability to get qualified underwriters or to staff ourselves up as we see more and more people you know, claiming through their insurance. You know, if it is this structural change and the insurance industry has sort of been operating a particular way for the, you know, last decade or two decades, then what do we need to do? How do we adapt to that change going forwards? Ian, maybe from a retail perspective, start with you.
Yeah, I guess, well, many players in the industry, I guess we've talked about two channels that haven't been going well for distributing insurance, the retail advice and superannuation, but I think we've seen reasonable growth in direct channels, so and that has, I guess, helped the profitability of a number of industry participants. And I guess I think it's a slightly healthy tension for the industry that we have got these multiple channels, and at certain times some are going to be more attractive and some are going to be others are going to be more attractive from both a consumer perspective and a shareholder perspective.
Darren, are you from group insurance side?
Look, I think there's lots of conversations going on with clients around changing terms and conditions, and it's not straightforward. There's lots of constraints. Super funds have superannuation law, the fiduciary duty to members, advice requirements, they have to notify members, and administration constraints around what they can do. But I guess by and large what we're seeing is funds would prefer to change than have ongoing massive increases in premiums. And certainly we're seeing a little bit of change now in terms of conditions that will come through.
And Mark, look, from a reinsurance side, RGA has been fairly vocal in the sorts of issues they've seen in the market. I guess as a provider of capital to the broader industry, what's it going to take to make it more attractive from your perspective?
Well, I guess we're on record for group business that we're not quoting for new TPD under the current terms, but we will quote on other terms, and there are, that's leading to some discussion, so that's a good sign, I think. It's also leading to some discussions about other benefits, which I think is also a good thing. But in general, I guess if we look back at 2013 for the reinsurers, it was a horrific year. If you add up the losses, and this is just off the public information, it's close enough to $1 billion. In fact, it might even be more. I don't know exactly. So it's a big event that's happening in the reinsurance market, and it's pretty uniformly spread around, certainly for the people, the reinsurers that have been here for a good number of years. So we're getting a lot of attention on global markets for all the wrong reasons. So you don't want to lose $1 billion very often, is probably another way of saying that. So the reinsurers are looking to see where they can change things. There's a lot going on, though. I mean, this has kind of happened so quickly that if you look at the group side, it's just happened so too quickly for everyone to really keep up and react. I mean, if you think about it from a trustee's perspective, as recently as maybe 18 months ago, they're still having people come along talking about either benefit improvements or price decreases, and then suddenly a bomb's gone off. And so the whole dynamic's changed. So we've got to let some of this play out and time to just elapse for the communication and education to seep through. Now, you ask about what else could be done. I mean, I think the regulators are doing an awful lot. So APRA, if you're here, thank you. There's a lot happening already, so I don't know if we need a lot more from that space yet.
Yeah, that actually leads me to sort of the next question. Obviously, we talk a lot about what individual organisations are doing, and we're all operating in a competitive market. I guess kind of back to Darren's analogy, we're sort of bumbling around the dark trying to figure out, who killed, one of these Cluedo characters. So, as an organisation, what are you guys doing to, try and identify the real crux of the problem or the problems that exist, and then work to try and resolve some of those things? So, Darren, maybe start with you.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that there's a lot of analysis going on in most companies at the moment. I think there's probably less quoting and more introspection on the group side. And I guess in terms of making things sustainable, it's all about the conversation about terms and conditions. Because price is not the answer. Price, you can't keep putting the price up forever. On the retail side, there's one of the things that we've been doing is trying to encourage level commissions. And we've had lots of good conversations with advisors around moving away from the high upfronts. And I think it seems to be gaining ground and gaining a bit of traction. And also moving away from yearly renewable term to more level premium type products. The conversations there are quite promising as well. It's early days.
Ian?
Yeah, I agree that I think analytics has been quite an important focus for many organisations at the moment, because I guess certainly what we're finding is that the issues aren't uniform over portfolios necessarily, and what you tend to find is certain segments which are truly horrific, and the rest is just not very good for some of the historically priced schemes. So really doing that analytical work and then speaking to the super trustees around what steps they can take to get a benefit design which gives an affordable premium rate to their members is important, because I think there's now a concern that that there is a risk that people's retirement aspirations are going to be eroded by the level of life insurance benefits we're providing. Now, I think in terms of the dollars of cover, they're not unreasonable. It's really the claiming conditions which are putting the cost pressure. And I think trustees will need to address the fact that we maybe can't afford to have Rolls-Royce or Mercedes for all our members, and we probably need to see if we can offer a good value Holden, maybe.
And I guess it, as always is the way with these things, people, and particularly sort of the media likes to sort of latch on to a particular idea and then make it a sort of recurring theme. So, throughout sort of a lot of the life insurance debate, there's been this intense focus around churn in particular, and ASIC's in the midst of walking through their particular process. I guess, I guess what would be interesting in from your perspective is how big, is this churn, this potential churn problem, and is it sort of an issue that requires a lot of focus, or is it something that's getting more headlines than it really deserves? Maybe Ian, let's start with you.
It is certainly an issue, and in particular, I guess when you you almost get the first, well, the last entrance advantage is often quite interesting in the retail advice space, and I guess I've probably seen this more in New Zealand than Australia, where a new company coming in can offer quite generous terms without having to worry about the pricing impact on their back book. And that does, I guess, cause some issues from a churn perspective if you're an existing player. But I guess we do it to ourselves as well in the product design that we put out. Encourages customers to look elsewhere, go and get some advice when they've received a 15 or 20% increase. And we've done a fair amount of research into this area, and yes, it's more than churn. A lot of it is economically driven, and sometimes it's frankly rationally driven from a consumer perspective. When you get into your 50s, you're starting to get to the point where your risk is towards living too long rather than dying too soon. So at some point it makes sense to scale down your cover, regardless of whether or not the actuary has assumed that you're going to keep it for another 5 to 10 years on average. As an individual, you're going to make some decisions from time to time which aren't going to be favourable for the company.
Mark, do you have any perspective on that?
Well, I've got no particular data on churn, otherwise I'm sure ASIC would be down at our place regularly, but look, ASIC are doing their investigation. I'm sure they'll find something. They wouldn't do an investigation if they didn't know they're going to find something, but it's very hard to believe it's the big issue. I mean, our lapse rates were typically 12 to 15%. Now they've gone to 18 or so percent. So it's gone up a bit, but it's not just churn. The numbers are just too big. It would require almost every advisor to be focused solely on churn all the time. So I think the word churn's got such nice negative sort of connotations and emotions attached. Everyone likes to throw it out and allows you to point the finger somewhere else, and you kind of avoid the fact that there's a really a lot of things that the individual life insurers can do to control this better than what it has been. And the exit studies that we've been involved with our clients, the people who have left, very few of them say, well, the advisor told me to move just so they can get another commission. There was always good other reasons, and just so happens the advisor was getting another commission again on the way.
And Darren, just want to pick up on sort of some of the discussion, particularly around group insurance, and I guess, you know, we've all seen sort of some of the premium rate increases that are coming through, and I think you've all made the point, you know, given what's happening in that market at the moment, and given that superannuation primarily set up as a retirement vehicle, just how far can these rate increases go until they start, you know, significantly impacting, you know, essentially the retirement outcomes for members, and what are, you know, businesses like yours doing with those clients in terms of assessing, you know, new models, new ways of operating?
Mm. Well, I think you're right. If premiums get too high, you chew into the members' account balance. And the purpose of compulsory superannuation, the main purpose is retirement savings. It's not insurance. Insurance is a secondary purpose. And we've had some very good discussions with our clients. And it's interesting. Industry funds, I think, are new mutuals. They're the new mutuals of this century. And they're building up their expertise. There's a number of industry funds are employing more and more actuaries, you can see that. And so the conversation now is a very sophisticated conversation between the insurer and the industry fund around price, getting into assumptions and details. I think that's been very useful. In terms of one of the things that we're keen to do is to long-term move away from the old three-year guarantee process where you set the rates for 3 years and you cross the fingers and roll the dice and hope that it works. So I think there's a move away to more sophisticated approaches with sort of annual resetting of premiums, but a very sort of more open and transparent way of dealing.
Any other comment?
Yes, I guess, as I said in my remarks, it's the three-year guarantee it sometimes helps a bit. I'm a little nervous at the prospect of having to reprice all our major schemes on an annual basis. I think we might have
a hell of a lot of work.
Yes, a lot of work. I might have to put a few job adverts out to cover that level of work. I guess the other issue that I think is relevant in terms of the impact on members' funds is current financial conditions. Interest rates are still pretty low. Returns on equities, although there's been a good rebound since the low of GFC in the long term, we don't want to chew up too much of our members' returns. And I guess the nightmare product probably is long-term income protection, which with current low interest rates is very expensive for members. And it's coming out of a fund which is probably not getting great returns because interest rates are so low.
So I might just make the point that this erosion of savings is very serious, that the SG increase from 9 to 9.25%, almost all of that in most industry funds has been gobbled up by the increase in group life premiums, almost all of it. So we just can't keep doing that. As an industry, it's not sustainable.
Please. I'm happy to throw it to if people have got questions. Please make your way to the microphone. And
thanks, Wade. Just to ask the question about data, in a sense, the fact you can't answer where the problems have come from suggests that we haven't been collecting enough data historically to really monitor this business. And one thing that has struck me is that data is very much a strategic question. We collect it now for analysis 5-10 years down the track. Is this crisis leading to some changes, or should this crisis be leading to some changes in the amount of data we collect? And if not, if companies aren't doing it, is there a need for an industry-wide or profession-wide activity?
Go ahead, Dan.
One of the wonderful things about APRA's new prudential standards for superannuation funds is it places an obligation on trustees to collect and maintain sufficient and adequate data so that an insurer can price a group insurance scheme. So the onus and level of governance around the collection and maintenance of data has increased. So that's a good thing. And also the FSC is currently has a working group put together to have some member standards some standards around data which supplement and go a bit further than APRA prudential standards. So I think that there's some things happening in the industry which are pushing in the right direction.
Anyone else want to add to that? Yeah, Francis, please.
I think the panel's indicated that trustees are facing the awkward choice between significant price increases and reductions in benefits, and probably over the last 12 months they've chosen the price increases, which is, I think everyone agrees, not sustainable. If they are going to move to more de-risk benefit designs, what is the, well, how are they going to get there and how quickly, and what signs are you seeing of that in the market?
Ian, do you want to start with that?
I guess so far I haven't seen big movements from trustees, but I have seen an acceptance to maybe close what you might regard as loopholes, which are really seeing, in some cases, you're seeing very, very excessive costs from a feature which I guess neither the trustee nor the insurer thought was going to be that expensive, or a concession that neither thought was going to be expensive. That seems to be relatively easy to get some process. In terms of the overall benefit designs at a top level, so far I haven't seen much movement.
I think the conversation takes a long time. As I said, there's lots of stakeholders, lots of process. But I think we are beginning to see some real change. Certainly, there's some very large funds that now have reduced automatic acceptance limits, significantly reduced. And I think we'll see other terms and conditions changes come to the market in the next little while.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. There's been small changes already agreed and factored in coming through, but the big changes are still under discussion. But it's a different discussion now to even 12 months ago. The trustees are asking what needs to change, but then there's the process that works through, because there's a lot of stakeholders involved, including the administrator and the trustees, insurer, reinsurer, sometimes multiple versions of each.
I should have said before, can you identify yourself when you ask a question on where you're working? That'd be great. Thanks.
My name's Richard Land from Mercer, and I'd just like to provide feedback that I do feel that there's appetite for trustees to look at definitions, automatic acceptance limits, etc., for the trade-off on the price side. And I think probably there's, as you say, it's a slow process, and I think the insurers probably aren't quite ready yet, based on some tenders we've seen, to say that this change in definition is worth this. This change in automatic acceptance level is worth roughly this, and just how it's going to pan out like that. But in my opinion, I think that the interests of the various stakeholders really are starting to align now, and I can see both insurers and trustees both looking at sustainable ways of containing premium increases, and I actually see that there can be sustainable outcomes. So the trustees know that the days of just putting it out to tender and getting all the insurers to compete against themselves and get the best of all worlds, it's known as it's over. So that's accepted, and I think the interests, as I say, are aligning, and there's a chance to get some sustainability in there.
Great, thank you. And it looks as though we're getting the wind up. So I guess, guys, any sort of final comments that you'd like to make in terms of your thoughts on where we're at, you know, obviously, it's been a tough 18 months, 2 years, and is there hope for the insurance industry going forward?
Look, I think we're very blessed to have superannuation here and to have it as a distribution vehicle for insurance. Most other markets would die to have, you know, such access to so many people. We've just got to get it right.
Well, it has been a tough 18 months, and I guess I've only been in Australia for 18 months, so I seem to have missed me. So my timing hasn't been great, but I guess, during these sorts of times, I guess it's a chance for us really to learn what went wrong and try and fix it for the next time. So I'm looking forward to that.
Darren?
I was going to say, I came into life insurance again after 17 years, 2 years ago, and ever since then I've seen premium increases between 50 and 100%, so I just assume this is how the industry works. So.
Well, on that positive note, please put your hands together. I think it's been a really interesting session, and enjoy the rest of the conference.